So good morning, everyone. It's a real pleasure to host you at the Collège de France for this 2 days conference on cell motility, which Jean-François Joigny and I have organized. So I want to take anything more time than just greeting you and thanking you for coming. It's going to be fun. Coffee break will be served at the lobby, which is located in the stairway just one floor down. You just follow the crowd. There's another conference working, you know, on economics, which is not our business. So you may mix them, but you know, they have a different dress code, definitely. Anyways, thank you. And so the first speaker this morning is Robert Insel, who is coming to us from Glasgow, and he will be telling us about cell motility. I won't say more. Thank you, Robert, for coming.
Thank you very much. What a wonderful meeting, and it's so nice to be back with people again. Lovely to see you. Thank you, both organizers. And let me pile straight in. Nothing like piling straight in. I want to show you something that is the result of mathematics and modeling that you probably couldn't possibly understand or predict without. So it's a spoiler. So there are some cells chemotaxing up a gradient. They're not very efficient. We make cells chemotax much better up some gradients. There are some cells chemotaxing up a second gradient. And again, you can see they go up the gradient, not perfectly efficiently, but they go. And if you mix those two gradients, they go the other way. So I'm hoping at the end of this talk that you'll be able to understand why. Okay, let me start by thanking people so it doesn't come at the end. This is a mixture of a wonderful, wonderful set of different teams of people. Andy up there is a medic, an oncologist. These guys are, John is a mathematician, Michele is an engineer, and Luke and Adam are both mathematicians who have converted to doing experiments in the lab. So that's a nice team, and that's the way we work at the moment. And then, of course, loads of other people involved. I'm going to talk a little bit about LPA, and the work for that was done with Mike Wakelin's lab. And Mike Wakelin was the first person to die in the COVID epidemic, who any of us had heard of, and there's a memorial meeting for him in a couple of weeks. So we're very sad about that. And all these other people, I won't list their names, but it's a load of work to talk about here. Now, last time I gave this talk, somebody posted this on Twitter, and I thought Thomas would like it, and everyone here. It's Bob May, a very famous mathematician of evolution and populations, about self-organization of biological systems. He said, if it doesn't organize itself, who the is going to organize it for you? And that is a great theme in the work we do. If it isn't going to organize itself, who is going to organize it? I want to address two questions, which are both totally to do with self-organization in the end. One of them is, where do chemoattractant gradients come from, in vivo in particular? And the second is, forward chemotaxis is very interesting, where cells climb up a gradient. How is it possible for cells to do reverse chemotaxis, where they go backwards, away from a gradient? Turns out to be a much more interesting question than you might think. Let's just go straight into the first of these. And my story begins with melanoma. And actually, we did a whole load of this work when talking here in Paris with Lionel Leroux. Melanoma spreads by chemotaxis. And there are lots of bits of evidence showing that melanoma spreads by chemotaxis. But the biggest one, you just get by looking at a melanoma. You don't see a whole load of cells in the middle, like a sort of haze of cells outside, as if it was a Gaussian. You see these sharp edges, and you see these strong variations and so forth. And that's telling you, in particular, like, for example, there, the fact that you have this great density of cells outside tells you that the cells are deliberately moving outwards. And in order to try and understand this, Andy, the first person I showed you, did these chemotaxis experiments. We build chambers, and we love devising different kinds of chemotaxis experiments. So this is an experiment with a chemotaxis chamber. Sally Zygmunt made the first. This is a version I made. So you've got low serum on that side, and you've got high serum on that side, and you're going to put the cells in one side and watch what happens. And this is actually really, really scary. What you are seeing is death. If you were a patient and you had a melanoma, then what you're seeing in this, if the cell's coming from the melanoma into your bloodstream, and that is why melanoma is lethal. That is why melanoma is frightening. And when we got these assays going, I went straight to the doctor and showed the doctor the black spots on my body and said, do I have to worry? Because seeing this every day ought to make you frightened. The black spots on my body were fine. So here's the questions we want to ask. The real question we want to ask is, where does the information come from? When a melanoma spreads outwards and when a melanoma spreads into your body, how does it know? Because if it moves randomly, it will go nowhere. Random migration on this sort of scale is the most inefficient thing imaginable. But if the moment you start being directed, then you have melanoma spreading. And actually, you can ask this question a different way, in the same sense as the Bob May quote I gave early, which is, if you have a melanoma, why does your body make a gradient to make the melanoma cells chemotax out of the melanoma and kill you? It seems a stupid thing to do. And the answer is, of course, your body does not make the gradient. The melanoma makes the gradient. The melanoma cells make the gradient that make the melanoma cells move. And the best way of showing it is like this. This was supposed to be a control. Never do controls, they mess everything up. This is exactly the same assay that I showed before with the high serum on that side. But this time we put high serum on that side as well. So the cells should go nowhere. And what happens when you do the experiment? It's absolutely indistinguishable. There really is no difference at all. For about 1 year I was giving this talk and I swapped the movies around because they're so similar I couldn't tell the difference. Okay, why are these two things the same? Because serum has got masses of chemoattractant in it, a huge amount of chemoattractant in it. And the thing that is making the gradient is not the fact that I've put high on one side and low on the other. It's that the cells take the serum and they break down some of the chemoattractant that's in it. And when the cells break down the chemoattractant, you get a gradient. Where the cells are is low. So this side is high and this side is low. And you can actually see what I'm saying is right, because do you see you have this wave of cells along here, and everyone behind this wave has no direction at all. And the reason they have no direction at all, if the cells in the wave at the front, there, they've consumed all of the chemoattractant. Now, in this assay, the chemoattractant is LPA, lysophosphatidic acid. It's not clear to me that LPA is the chemoattractant when you have a melanoma in your body, but the system is exactly the same. The cells chemotax, you can see the cells chemotaxing in a wave to a gradient that they've made themselves. So this is the origin of the term self-generated gradients. The cells make the gradients and the cells respond to them. And it's complex and it's beautiful and we like it very much. But it does give us a real interesting problem. In that assay I've shown you, how are you going to measure the chemoattractant gradient? I can't go in with a Pasteur pipette and remove some of the liquid and take it off to be measured. I can't do that because the cells are constantly making the gradient, and the gradient is diffusing back from the areas of high attractant. And so if I take the cells away and go with a Pasteur pipette, then there's no gradient anymore. The gradient is being made dynamically on the fly constantly. So how do you measure things that are not measurable? And we tried all sorts of ways, but the one that is the most useful is actually just using mathematical models, because the cells are behaving in a complex, beautiful way. And then we look to see, and we parameterize the models based on things we can measure one at a time from the cells. But then we make these spatial models. Look, here's a spatial model of a self-generated gradient. This shows you exactly what those melanoma cells are doing. They're making a gradient. Oopsie-daisy. The gradient is here. The cells are behind the gradient. The cells that are in the wave keep moving as they make a gradient. The cells that are left behind the wave see nothing at all. And we can measure lots of parameters one at a time in cells, but the only way you can stick them together dynamically and spatially is with models. Now, interesting audience. I don't know this audience well. How many of you will be happy if I present results based on models? Or how many of you would just say, models, schmodels, give me an experiment? Let me see hands, please. How many people are happy with models? Many, good, well done, people. How many people are not happy with models? How many people are, this is amazing. Oh, really? Don't be shy. Oh, okay. I'll change my talk slightly accordingly then. Anyhow, you see the point in this experiment. There's lots of attractant. The attractant is saturating. The attractant being saturating is what makes the wave, because any cell that gets a little bit ahead is then in too much attractant to be directed, so it hangs behind. And it's totally self-organized. All the information here is coming from the cells and where the cells are. And so we love models, we love experiments. Here are two, I showed you a picture of Luke on the right. Matt on the left was a mathematician. I made him do experiments. He didn't like them. So Matt is still a mathematician. Matt is still a mathematician. Luke is now the best microscopist in the group. That's fine. That's the way to do it. Models make our experiments better. Our experiments make our models better. We try and make everyone do both to some degree, because if you do both to some degree, then you understand. Okay, here's some real cells. You see exactly the same thing happens with details. These are dictyostelium cells. They will go for miles and miles and days. We can make them go for several centimeters, and they keep on going this wave. It's a bit noisier here. You see the computer following them and marking the cells in green if they're doing positive chemotaxis, red if they're going backwards. And you see, again, this wave at the front, and the wave moves and moves and self-organizes. Here's a really, really complicated one. I was amazed. Olivia, a remarkable postdoc, was doing this. This is the monoblasts moving in a mouse. So when you're an embryo, you are completely pale, and the monoblasts move from your neural crest round to your tummy, and they move round to your shoulder and down your arm. And this is the monoblasts. There they are, labeled with GFP, in the shoulder of an embryo. And this is the shoulder, and this is the fingers. And if you watch the GFP monoblasts, you can see, again, the same thing. You can see a wave in the front. And the ones that are at the front of the arm keep moving down towards the paw, and the ones that are further behind are not directed. So the reason you can get cells migrating all the way from the neural crest down to your fingers is that they self-generate a gradient that draws them back. And also, in just the same way as actually our models, sheds a few cells along they go. And those few cells that are shed are presumably the ones that give you skin pigment. And this sort of process has all manner of really interesting consequences. And I hope I can explain this clearly enough in only a few slides. I deleted lots of slides to show you some new work. But let me try. So imagine that cells are chemotaxing, but while they chemotax, they have to make a decision. So there's the upper branch and the lower branch. The cells are coming from here. They're making their own gradient. So you'll see them in the model making the gradient if they go. And you'll see what happens is a little bit complex. And it's a little bit complex because the blue line is a connection to the outside world. So the blue line keeps supplying chemoattractant, so the cells that choose the bottom line can keep chemotaxing. But the cells that choose the top line run out of attractant, and so they can't chemotax anymore. So let's show that again, it's nice. So at first, cells go both ways. But then there's nothing left in the top, so they all tend to go to the bottom. That's just the sort of thing that we start seeing happening. Now, what happens if you make the closed branch a little bit shorter? Well, now you see something really interesting. Now what you see is that almost no cells are going to choose the top branch, because by the time they've reached it, they've broken down all the attractant. And the attractant has been able to diffuse out of the branch, And so they know that they should all go to the bottom branch. So the cells can use breaking down a chemoattractant to make a decision which way to go. And what that means is crazy. What that means, if the cells can solve arbitrarily complex paths, and they can see around corners. So here you see a model of a sort of complex maze, and each time the cells reach a junction in that maze, they have broken down enough of the attractant ahead of them that they can tell which is the right way to go. So again, you can see in each case the correct branch has a slightly higher concentration than the lower one, and cells are amazingly sensitive to small differences in attractant. Cells have no problem doing this. Now, it's very unfortunate that none of you said you wouldn't trust models, because reality turns out to be a very good approximation to my nice models. And of course, the reason we can do the reality is that the models tell us what will work and tell us what the cells can and can't do. And in this case, there are actually some mistakes in this. Do you see the cells behind the front now do some migration? But it turns out that that is because our presumptions were incorrect and that the cells are still able to talk to one another. So we can mutate the genes that allow these cells to talk to one another, and then it behaves exactly like the model does. The models are that perfect. And having models that are that perfect for chemotaxis and self-generated chemotaxis lets us build stupidly complex things and discover things that we didn't believe we could a year or two ago. So, of course, some of you may say, these models are beautiful, but in this case you've put dictyostelium cells in them, although they work fine with cancer cells too. What is the biological relevance? But of course, actually, that maze is the most biologically relevant thing you can imagine. Because if you are an immune cell, and if I have been pruning the roses in my garden and I prick my finger and fill my finger with foul bacteria, then what the neutrophils have to do is they're in the bloodstream, and they have to negotiate around the endothelial cells, and ideally they'll go along a fascia rather than straight through a tissue, and they follow exactly the same path, the same idea as those models that I showed you the cells going through. And when you're an embryo, multiple of the cells that were in you when you were an embryo have to do a similar problem. The germ cells are the most amazing example. The germ cells are made in a completely different place from the gonad. Why does your body do this? I do not have a clue. There are some theories. A lot of them are a bit boneheaded, I think. But the germ cells are made elsewhere, and the germ cells have to chemotax to the gonad. But they can't chemotax to the gonad in a straight line because there's other cells in the way. What they have to do is they have to chemotax by the way that gets them there and is effective. And it's not a surprise that the chemotaxis of the germ cells to the gonad always seems to be done by self-generated gradients. And neural pathfinding plainly involves chemotaxis, but if you just have a certain number of chemoattractants, the number of neurites is insane, and the number of chemoattractants is small, so you're not going to manage it effectively if the cells are just migrating up static gradients. But if you have a complex system, a self-generated system, then that gives you much more scope, etc., etc., etc. Basically, we now think whenever you see chemotaxis occurring, it is much more likely to be self-generated chemotaxis than it is imposed by someone else giving you the gradient. And that suits us fine because we believe in self-organization. We don't think it's a very good answer to say, oh, someone else made a chemoattractant. We don't think that explains very much. But if you say the cells interacted with one another, and as a result of the cells interacting with one another, a chemoattractant gradient was formed, that seems to me to be biology. Anyhow, so you can make cells do stupid things. This is King Henry VIII's maze in Hampton Court. And the ones in the front solve it much better than people do. If you ever see the real maze, you can see an awful lot of people paying a lot of money to get lost. But those cells in the front do very, very well. And they know the answer. Again, they can sense the answer. But have a look at the beginning here, because there's a really funny thing. There's a mistake in the maze. So look at that bit when it restarts. This one was imperfect, and the cells can actually see the imperfection. The cells could smell the imperfection. So this maze is very like getting through IKEA, you know. The cells have sensed that you can actually miss out the sofas section, and they don't want sofas, so they're very happy with that. And this made us laugh. So what we did was we replaced that, which is just a mistake, with a deliberate way through here. So there's the maze. You see, we've built a new path through it. And now what you see is really quite funny. It's quite sad, really. The cells that go through the front, some of them are able to sense that shortcut, and they just bang down it. And once those cells at the front have banged through the shortcut, the other ones up here are lost. Because the ones that took the shortcut ate all the chemoattractant, and so there's no information left to rescue the other ones. So they're doomed to wander around King Henry VIII's maze for the rest of their lives, poor souls. Okay, sorry, I don't know where this slide came from, I didn't delete it. Okay, talk to me about that if you want any more questions. I mean, if you have any more questions, there are loads of interesting consequences for this. In my last five or so minutes, I just want to talk about something related that we've been working on, which is how the cells do reverse chemotaxis. So is reverse chemotaxis real? Nobody believed it was until fairly recently, until this kind of experiment. This is a zebrafish. This is a zebrafish where some of the neutrophils have migrated out into the tail, which has been wounded. And they've color changed the ones that were in the tail to make them red. And what you can see, it was dogma that this never happened. Some of them have migrated back into the vasculature and reverted. And this is called reverse chemotaxis. So they chemotaxed out to go and see the wound, and then they chemotaxed back in again afterwards to join the vasculature. Now, is negative chemotaxis understood? Easy, no. I haven't got time to explain why there are real problems with negative chemotaxis, but it is very difficult to understand how a eukaryotic cell may do negative chemotaxis. Bacteria do it with no trouble at all, but eukaryotic cells find it very difficult indeed. So I'm going to cut straight to the chase. There's not very much time left. Let's look at this. If you have a gradient of a chemoattractant, the reason the cells can tell that there is a gradient of the chemoattractant is that their receptors get activated. Not in a linear way. They always get more activated at the low end and always get less activated at the high end because they are saturated and other things. If you have something that is a competitive inhibitor, that is to say, something that binds to the chemoattractant receptors but does not activate them, does not turn them on, then you still get a gradient, but you get no activation of the receptors. So if you have something that binds to a receptor but doesn't activate it, then the cells will not be able to tell it's there. But if you mix the two of them together, you see a different thing. So if you have some kind of background level of a chemoattractant and then a gradient of the thing that binds to the same receptor but doesn't activate it, then what you see looks a bit like this. Because at this end of the gradient, about half the receptors are activated by the chemoattractant. And at that end, more of the receptors have bound something, but they're nearly all bound to this thing that doesn't stimulate them. So you get more receptors activated at the low end of the gradient and less receptors at the high end. So what we're seeing is not really negative chemotaxis. The cells are not chemotaxing backwards up a gradient of the red stuff. But what they're doing is they're reading the interaction between two different chemoattractants, and they're making their gradient out of that. Can we see anything like this in reality? Yes, we can. Look, here's a very interesting experiment. The microneedle here contains something that the mathematicians love. If you read the mathematics of chemotaxis literature, you see lots of people talking about chemorepellents. But we did an experiment rather carefully with a needle there that's been filled with a chemorepellent, and the cells don't care. And the cells don't care because we were careful about making sure that the environment was clean and well-washed and so forth. So the well-known chemorepellent is not, in fact, a chemorepellent. But if you put a little dash of a chemoattractant from outside in there, then suddenly this chemo repellent becomes very nasty indeed, and the cells run away from it. So this negative chemotaxis is not being caused by the repellent alone. It's an interaction between two different agents acting on one receptor. And again, we think this is wonderful. We think this is because all of the things that are doing chemotaxis in your body, very, very few of them are simple and only have one ligand for one receptor. All of the chemokines in your body and all the lipid signals in your body and so forth, all of them, there are multiple signals all working on any one receptor. So this kind of effect is going to happen a lot. Let's look at a few others. This is just a bridge. So here we are. This is the same experiment I showed you before with the cells everywhere. And this is what happens if you give cells flat chemoattractant. They move around, they're happy, nothing happens. If you give them a very steep gradient of the inhibitor, then again nothing happens. The interesting thing here is they stop making protrusions at all, which we didn't expect, but again they're not going anywhere. But if you mix the repellent and the attractant, then the cells whoosh backwards. I have one or two to do if you. So that's nice. That is by far the strongest chemo repulsion assay that I've ever seen anyone do, by far the clearest. Now, here are some really interesting things, and this is where we start saying, you know, we are doing real biology here, this is wonderful. If you make that same mix I showed you before, but the cells are able to degrade the attractant, then you get this marvelous complex behavior. We call this the Moses effect, because Moses parted the Red Sea. So on one side, the cells are breaking down the chemoattractant to make a steeper gradient. So on this side, the chemoattractant dominates. On this side, the cells have broken down so much chemoattractant that the chemorepellent dominates. So you get a split, and the point where it splits from tells you the ratio of the affinities for the of the agents for the receptor. Really, more interesting still, can you reverse this? If you use a chemorepellent that the cells can degrade, what happens? And it turns out, yes, totally. The cells at the high end break down the repellent and it becomes more repulsive. The cells at the low end have no chemorepellent, so the attractive thing dominates. Now, you've got to emphasize this line here. I'm not putting anything there. This is an interaction between two different chemoattractants that the cells are breaking down as they go. So the cells made that line, not me. And again, this is biology and this is wonderful. So let me come to that last thing I showed you. Saying, instead of having a flat gradient of your attractant, you have a shallowish gradient like this. Starting with a little bit of chemoattractant and going to a little bit higher. That's a positive gradient. The cells will be able to read that. Saying your competitor is not a perfect competitor, saying it only activates the receptor 5% of the time, then this gradient here will still be red because you will have more, you'll have no stimulated receptor there, and you'll have 5% of the receptor stimulated there. So again, this will be a positive gradient. But if you mix the two of them together, then your receptors are about half stimulated on this side, and they're about 5% or a little bit more stimulated on this side, so the gradient runs backwards. So that is how that side is positive, that attractant is positive, and that attractant is also positive, but the two of them mixed together give you a reverse signal. And here's just some nice cell quantitation porn to show it's true. That's the one attractant, that's the other attractant, and that's what you see if you mix them. It's plainly true. Okay, so weak chemoattractants. They are attractants on their own. If you look through the literature and people say X is a chemoattractant, then it is a chemoattractant, but it may be a weak chemoattractant. It doesn't mean what it's doing in vivo, is what people have said in the papers. They can become repellents or other things if they are in the presence of other attractants. In other words, when a chemoattractant works in your body, there are always other chemoattractants around, so this interaction is key. Okay, that's me. I thought you'd enjoy that last little bit. I hope it was clear enough. I can give everyone a much longer explanation if they need it. Just to give you some conclusions, we cell biologists love to say simple things. In things like chemotaxis, we have to stop it. Complexity is your friend. Complexity is interesting. Complexity is wonderful, so long as you have something like models to understand it. The other thing we have to get our minds around, because people don't think this way, is that cells and chemoattractants interact with one another, and the result of that interaction is information. And finally, if you get things like interacting chemokines, the results are non-trivial and they are interesting, and they're cool. Maybe I'll leave there. Thank you very much.